study the potential for a shortened legislative session, thereby saving state dollars and resources. But most importantly, number four, a greater utilization of all 60 legislators and their expertise. Traditionally, the Senate and House Finance Committees are made up of the more senior members of each body. The House Finance Committee members serve on no other committees. In many cases, we are missing their valuable input, wisdom, and vast experience in legislation creation due to fiscal time restraints. A two-year process would give all legislators a chance to voice their opinions in the early stages of legislation and budget development. But what about emergency needs or supplemental requirements? A biennial budget process would not preclude supplemental budget considerations due to circumstances of need. These could be addressed on a case-by-case need. Nevertheless, the process would free up legislators to focus attention 1 year on budget, 1 year on legislation. 20 states have already adopted the biennial budget process. That's a good indication that other states are thinking outside the box. We believe Alaska needs to embrace a new way of thinking. We must look at new and innovative ways to conduct business. We encourage the dialogue in the biennial budget process to continue. And I appreciate the opportunity to give the Alliance perspective on HJR 2 and give it our support.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions for Ms. Cowart? Seeing none, we'll go next to Mark Langland. Mr. Langland?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead,
please. This is Mark Langland, and I am representing the Fiscal Policy Council of Alaska. And we had provided a letter to the Finance Committee, and I think to Representative Phillips, on support of her piece of legislation that we fully support. The items in our letter that we sent were three basic points addressing the efficiency of the process that would be gained by a biennial budget. And I think the key element to me would be how you could get the efficiencies out of, more efficiencies out of your results-based budgeting that you already put in place. I think this fits in quite nicely with that. And I think the other point that I'd like to emphasize is that the fiscal plan that you are or will eventually put in place fits in very nicely with the biennial budget. I do think it provides us with a better degree of stability and certainty for all parties, whether you're a citizen, whether you're an agency or a legislator, the governor, and a business person like myself, knowing what is out in front of us and how it would be funded, even in a situation, I think, where we do have volatility in the revenue base, I think it's even more of an argument to have this sort of a budget process because we do have the Constitutional Reserve Fund to pick up the slack. So it forces, I think, the legislature on a long-term basis to keep those funds in place to provide for that shock absorber effect caused by the fluctuation of earnings. And having the biennial, I think, benefits that process rather than thinking of it as a negative. So I think it dovetails in very well with the unique needs that we have as a state on the financial, fiscal plan anyway, because of these fluctuations. I think also as you look at the needs of our state in a longer term basis of economic development, where we're trying to look at long-term plans for infrastructure, whether it be a hard rock or timber or fish or whatever, I think the longer you can plan, the longer you can count on where the state is going from a financial standpoint, I think it gives more credibility to the process and give more comfort, if you will, to the business community as far as the direction of the state is concerned. So I think it forces all of us to look further ahead and plan, and I think it gives the legislature a better opportunity to try to get more efficiencies out of state government than the current process does. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Langland. Are there any questions for Mark? Mark, is Cheryl Fresca there, and does she wish to testify?
Yes, she is, and she has some testimony, too.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, Cheryl.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Cheryl Fresca, and I'm speaking to you out of reflection upon the 13 years that I spent working for the legislature as a staffer, primarily the finance committees, and then the 3 years that I spent over at OMB as budget division director. And then after those 17 years, I've spent time in the external world, as you know, often commenting and observing what the legislature is doing or not doing. So it's from all of those experiences that I express support for a biennial budget. The first reason is that while I appreciate the percent of its time that the legislature spends each session on budget work and the final authority that you do have over how much is appropriated each year, I can't emphasize enough the amount of time required for executive branch agencies to prepare their annual budget request to the legislature and to the legislature and the governor, but also to get the necessary work done in order to even start a new fiscal year and to then complete documentation in order to close out a fiscal year. All this takes a tremendous amount of time. A two-year budget cycle will provide significant productivity savings for both administrative and program staff involved in the various stages of budget work. While some legislators may be quick to translate this into a budget-cutting opportunity, I encourage them instead to view it as a way to redirect resources to another legislative priority, and that being your efforts in terms of missions and measures for various state programs. As you know, the next challenge will be for programs to gather information by which they can report on program performance. This process will significantly change future budget discussions by shifting them from the current how much more or less money a program got to the more important issue of the value Alaskans are getting for the dollars that are being spent. A two-year budget cycle will not only free up resources so programs can gather and report this performance information, it will also give program managers longer horizons to manage with what is often fewer dollars and increasing demands in order to achieve desired performance results. And in spite of what was said earlier, I believe that times have changed and the objections to a two-year budget cycle of the past are no longer relevant. Fluctuation in annual revenues is no longer a reason to not do this. Prior to the 1990s, certainly the spring revenue forecast did play a key role in determining how much money was to be spent in the next fiscal year. But during the 1990s, however, the forecast role has changed, and instead it serves as an indicator of how much money will come out of the CBR to pay for a level of spending determined by factors other than the state's expected revenues. And to Representative Davies' comment about the, I believe it was about legislature giving up some control, what I believe you would be doing is shifting away from focusing on the inputs into the state's programs and services and instead shifting it to evaluating the results or the outputs that are that you also have a responsibility for examining. So with that, I really urge you to pass HDR 2.
Thank you, Cheryl. Representative Bundy has a question for you.
Yeah, hi, Cheryl. Just speculating out loud here, if we had we're looking at, what, 2, 3, 5 year reservoir left in the CBR. So if we had a biennial budget and we had 3 years left or 2 years left, next year we start a biennial, would you say that we'd have used up the CBR in effect at a more rapid rate because we're using a two-year cycle, and that might, the unintended or maybe intended consequences would be to push us into a long-term plan because it just brings us to the cliff sooner because we've committed the money even though we haven't spent it.
Bingo.
Well, why don't you just tell us what you're wanting instead of subsidizing?
No, but I would also say you still have the fluctuation of revenues that still will determine the amount that will come out of the CBR, you know, over time. And on July 1st of a fiscal year, you don't withdraw 2 years' worth of revenues out of the CBR. So the fact is that we still won't know, even on July 1 at the start of that fiscal year, how much of the CBR will get taken over the next 2 years. But the fact is you do have a responsibility to make certain that there is enough in the CBR to make sure that it covers what you appropriate. And if it looks like it's not, then it's the legislature and the governor's responsibility to identify sufficient revenues to cover what they're appropriating, what you're appropriating. But it does bring some, if we're 2 years, if the cliff is that close, we've got problems. And it might help in an ironic way dramatize that point.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest then that if we do a biennial, that we want to make sure we're the group that uses up, commits the last amount of money, and then we'll leave it to someone else to figure out what to do from then.
I suggest we're well on track.
Okay, see who else we have here. Is there anybody else on teleconference to testify on this resolution? Okay, seeing none, we do have people here in Juneau. Let's see. Why don't we go to OMB first? Jack?
No, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. Before we get to the agencies, we do have the State Chamber here, and I don't see AML. Karen Brand is here from the State Chamber.
Okay. Karen, if you'd like to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For those of you who don't remember me, my name is Karen Brand. I'm now serving as Vice President of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. The Alaska State Chamber represents over 700 members across Alaska representing all industries. Some of our members range from small mom-and-pop stores to international corporations. For the last 3 years, the Board of Directors has passed resolutions in support of biennial budgeting, and you should have a copy of our most recent resolution in your packet. If not, I have an extra one here that I can get circulated. Basically, for the last 3 years, they've supported the concept. The one that you'll see from that was passed by our board in December of 99 for our priorities this year was part of a larger package that deals with some long-range financial planning issues. And with that, the Alaska State Chamber supports HGR2 and urges its passage.
Karen, we've heard the testimony that people like to see the state operate more in a business fashion, representing the State Chamber and individual chambers. Does the State Chamber or any of the individual chambers operate with biennial budgets, or do they budget on a yearly basis?
The State Chamber is on an annual budget cycle. I cannot speak for all of our local chambers. It's not something that I'd ever check into. That's a good question.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. I don't see Mr. Ritchie here for AML. He may come in later, so why don't we then go to OMB.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jack Farnioli. I'm a senior policy analyst with OMB in the governor's office. I'll be brief in my testimony. There are just a few points we'd like to make, and then I'd be happy to respond to any questions or concerns the committee may have. Basically, I'd like to say just up front that the governor supports very strongly the concept of biennial budgeting and thinks it would be, of course, you know, if done right, would be very good for the state of Alaska for several pretty fundamental reasons. One, I think we've pretty much touched on all of them, but just to recap them, we feel that it would work very well with for encouraging longer time frames for planning, not just fiscal planning, but also for program planning. We feel that it would work very well with the performance accountability initiatives that the legislature and the governor have endorsed and put into place over the last couple of years. And we feel that it would give a much needed and very beneficial emphasis to long-term planning within program areas. In whatever fashion a biennial budgeting approach were implemented, it would hopefully, I think this is one of its strongest points, allow for targeted depth of treatment, both by legislature and by program managers, to the longer-term policy needs within program areas. And that, we feel, would be a plus just in itself. Any time savings, et cetera, that may come from the approach in the various ways it could be implemented, we feel those would be benefits too. But certainly the emphasis on
looking at certain program areas, whether we're responding to federal mandates or looking for new directions within state government's treatment of certain programmatic areas, we feel this would be an approach that would be very commensurate with that, and that that would be a distinct benefit. We've looked at the cost and savings, if you will. We've taken putting into place a biennial budgeting approach. I will say right at the outset that we did the best job we could. It was a quick preliminary first analysis. I think what we found is what you have heard so far, that the greatest savings are likely to be in the area of any shortening of a legislative session under this legislation. Certainly in terms of employee impacts, the productivity savings would in all likelihood be the greatest savings, and those could be efforts and time savings that can be redirected to any other program kind of area or area of concentration. That would be a distinct benefit. The hard dollar savings we've heard reference to in travel and per diem, those would undoubtedly be in very concrete form hard dollar savings. They are limited in the sense that we no longer do as much travel as we have done in past years for budget preparation, but they would still be certainly not trivial. But that would be the form of the savings we would see as coming under a biennial budgeting regime. And we feel that those productivity savings and efforts that could be retargeted to other programmatic purposes would be a great benefit of this kind of a budgeting approach. I think the biggest and only real problem we have with the measure before us is a timing consideration. And it too has been touched on, and that is, and we don't feel that it's not reconcilable, but we feel it important enough to point out that with the measure calling for the question to be put before the voters in November, and departments and agencies normally beginning their budget development pretty much as soon as session is over, would leave us in a situation where the outcome of the ballot measure would not be known till November, but agencies would need to start sooner. I don't think it's anyone's desire that if the measure were to go forward, that departments and agencies prepare two budgets, or that the public and the departments live with the uncertainty of which format it might be. But we do feel that there are options for dealing with that timing question. And I can say that is our main concern with it. We've looked at several options, including doing, for example, the capital budget first and then the operating budget the following year. We've looked at the examples of other states, doing some programs the first year and the remainder the second year. Some states have done all their boards and commissions the first year, et cetera. An approach that some states have used and that we've used ourselves with developing our new budget system, the automated budget system, is that of a pilot approach, where a few departments selected for their representativeness so we could find out and learn from certain aspects of a procedure would be our preferred approach to it. That's simply to say that we feel there are these kinds of questions to talk about going forward to mitigate as best we can any anxiety about having to wait till November, and that would be the kind of thing that we would be interested in talking about, knowing that other people will have their preferences. The bottom line to that thread is that should the measure go forward, we would be looking forward to having discussions with legislators and following the lead of the legislature on this for joint talks during the summer. If it does go forward, we would like to have and believe there should be such joint talks to work up an acceptable implementation approach so that we wouldn't really be literally waiting in the dark until November and then suddenly having to react. I think it would be in everyone's interest to have that as understood and its contingencies identified as best as possible during the interim. So that, like I say, is our main concern, our only real concern with the legislation. We feel sort of one final substantive point about the legislation or the resolution is that if the approach were to be adopted, we feel that while it's obvious that there would always be in the second years of the biennial regime, there's always a need for supplementals and so on. Other states certainly have those. We have them now in an annual budgeting regime. We feel that, and this would be a discussion point we would propose during the summer, that additional provisions be discussed or at least considered for dealing with either economic or social changes of magnitude during the second years of the biennium, because in other states those have been really the sources for the greatest amount of legislative activity required during that out year. Another example would be federal changes in a particular area of a certain magnitude. To the degree those can be provided for in advance, I think that helps both the legislative process as well as the administration side process during the out year. Our fiscal situation, I think where we sort of feel is that, as the point's been made, really the budget reserve fund mitigates and certainly stabilizes the revenue flow to a degree that is very different from the time before we had the budget reserve fund. So I'm not speaking to the point of oil revenue volatility. Really talking about other economic changes or social changes that might arise. I do not have candidates in mind for it, but simply to make the point, federal programs have been the closest to what we've seen recently, where whole areas have suddenly been transformed. And those can best be treated, I think, positively by provisions in advance. I will finish up, Mr. Chairman, and simply reiterate the point that should the measure go forward, we would look forward to having discussions about implementation details.
Representative Bundy.
Thank you. As you point out, the Budget Reserve Fund has smoothed out some of the cycles, but what's your best guess on the projected longevity of the Budget Reserve Fund based on current spending practices and no changes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, I couldn't tell you, to be honest with you. I don't work with the Budget Reserve Fund numbers. My only observation would be that we've had it for some time now, and it's tended to be a shoulder of revenues about 2 years in front of us, and we seem to be perpetually running out of it in 2 to 5 years, but we're sort of into a long-term business on that. So I think it really depends on what gets done with it. We know its current amount of money, we know how long that would last, the current spending rates, but how long it lasts really depends on decisions that we get made.
Representative Davies earlier mentioned that in other states, the supplemental can magnify to be a significant piece of work. Have you looked at what the actual practices have been in other states and what the off-year supplemental has been like? How much?
I have, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bundy, the way other states have handled it almost completely fills the spectrum. There are states that have literally a legislative session every other year, but have during the second year, while they declare it not to be in session, it's an unbudgeted budget year, and they meet in full, including their finance committees and their subcommittees and staffs. On the other hand, there are legislatures that meet 2 years in a row and pretty much have only what we would call normal and expected amounts of supplemental activity. And really, there's not much that you can point to as a pattern, except that I think the general drift across all the 50 states is that, looking across the two-year span, the aggregate amount of legislative activity in a biennial regime has been somewhat more than the ideal theory would have people realize. That seems to be the only consensus that's been advanced by the National Conference of State Legislatures.
Thank you.
Representative Davies first.
I just wanted to kind of sum up so that from the governor's point of view, the primary dollar value and other value of this is that the legislature's around here less.
I think I'm understanding the attraction for the administration.
I would think that you all support.
And actually, that was getting to part of my question. I just try to imagine with the HESC budget in particular, with such large general funded programs built on formulas, usage of the formulas, caseload, Medicaid, for example, we try and estimate what the cost is going to be. Doing that for a year and coming in very pretty close to what it's going to be when you've got a program that spends $1 million a day, basically, is pretty tough. Now, if you ask me to do it 2 years out, it's going to be impossible, really. And so I'm wondering, when we come back in the second year and we look at the caseload growth and how the department's operating the program, are they being aggressive in accessing federal funds? The HESC budget committee chairman is going to have to basically go through, I think, the entire process that the subcommittee does now, except for he won't be putting numbers on a spreadsheet and handing it out. So I really don't see any savings in the HESC budget, you know, year to year, the way that that would work. I can see the attraction from the administration's point of view because we don't have the department under our control that second year. We're going to either cut their funding off, you know, as we pass the second year's budget, if they're not operating the program like we think it should be. But absent that, you're looking at a supplemental, basically, to cut the funding that's already been appropriated. And I think the dynamics for the legislature doing that is pretty tough. I just don't think, you know, from that budget in particular, the sensitivity of the budget, I don't think it works very well. Representative Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, an argument on the other side of that question, though, would be that you set out, the legislature sets out the policy, the funding policy, what they expect out of the department, and if we can free up some of the people that are constantly having to work putting together budgets to do the job that the legislature expects them to do, we are going to achieve savings. We are going to achieve greater productivity from them.
Some of it, Representative Phillips, is not it's not driven by efficiency or lack of efficiency, it's policy. It's the policy of how they want to operate the program, not whether they have enough man hours to operate it the way the legislature wants it to be operated.
But the legislature will set that policy, and that's not going to change.
No, the administration still administers. Representative Davies.
And I think that was the gist of my kind of comment. I mean, if you look at when OMB's analysis of where the substantial savings are, they aren't in the departments not working on the budget. They're in us not working on the budget. So that's my concern. My concern is that we're going to be given up effective oversight to the extent that we're not around here. And if the proposal were different, if a proposal were, for example, to do half the budget one year and half the budget the next year, so that we would be putting more oversight on it and having the departments work less on it, I might be more interested in it. But I'm concerned about, you know, taking the legislature even more out of the equation than it already is. Because my sense is that we don't put in the number of hours we need to understand the budget. And that the hours that Representative Terry was talking about are significant. And you know, backing away from that isn't going to improve the situation, to make it worse.
Mr. Chairman, there's only one body that can be held at fault for that, and that's this body. Well, this body would be the body to set the policy. If we think we need to be spending more time on the budget, then that's something that we can take care of, we can do.
Mr. Chairman, but this calls for reducing the amount of legislative time.
Can be spent in full session.
But have you tried to estimate the amount of time and the expense of that time of the legislature trying to do that oversight outside of the session? And I'm not saying that it would be dollar for dollar, but there would be an expense. And in the few conferences that I've gone to of state legislators and talked to members from other states, a number of them have said, well, basically that second year, we rewrite the budget, we go through all the motions, we just don't call it a new budget.
That didn't show up in the research that we did of all the 20 states. That philosophy didn't come through.
Well, I believe
it did in some, but not in all of them.
I believe that was part. I mean, not exactly that, but that was kind of what we heard from Jack and from the OMB, was that they looked at it and they said, if you look at what the CSL says and other places say, that the expected savings from the agencies is generally overrated, and that the real savings that we're talking about here is from us being out of session, and that's what concerns me.
Jack.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could respond, Representative Davies, that is what I said. The context in which that is, though, is that across all the efforts of the 50 states, yes, the trend, I think, and this is how NCSL has summed it up, has been that the savings and the benefits, even the non-savings benefits, better planning and so forth, have generally been across the board less than people have ideally expected. However, as I said in responding initially, the variation has been tremendous in that. And that question, I really think, begs the question of how Alaska, if it were to go forward with this kind of an approach, would fit itself to the possibilities inherent in the flexibility that the legislature does have in implementing any such regime. So I wouldn't, I don't want to overstate or overemphasize the value of the general conclusion NCSL offers, other than to offer it as a cautionary tone.
that there's not any more magic, I think, in general, we all know this, than people put into a program themselves. So really, in some sense, I think I would agree with Representative Phillips that the legislature has a lot of latitude for designing, implementing, using, structuring any such process that they would call or define as a biennial budgeting process. I believe the legislation or the resolution leaves them fairly unfettered in that. That sort of puts the burden on the legislature, but that opportunity could be there for Alaska to find, for example, the comfort that Wyoming has found in it. They're very happy with it. They're a small state similar to us. So I think really that's the only clarification I would offer.
Any other questions for Jack? Okay, we do have also here to testify.
Thank you.
See, why don't we go to Ginger Blaisdell with Legislative Finance.
For the record, I'm Ginger Blaisdell with Legislative Finance. And Representative Phillips asked our office to do an analysis of her proposed resolution. And I did more of a qualitative analysis, contacting other states that do biennial budgeting as well as states that do annual budgeting, and look at those who have recently transitioned one way or the other. And Tracy Carpenter on our staff did the quantitative analysis, looking at what possible fiscal savings there could be. Probably the easiest summary is that of the states I contacted, most of them had transitioned from an annual budget to a biennial budget, or have always been a biennial budget. In the last approximately 20 years, no states have gone from biennial to annual. And the reasoning behind the biennial and annual budgets began as more of a citizen farmer legislature, where people really did have to work every day of the year in order to make their living. And so a legislative action or being part of a legislature was supposed to be a very short-term time frame. All 50 states, actually it may not have been 50 at that time, all of the states began as biennial budgets, and well over half of them transitioned to annual budgets as state budget processes became more complex and as issues became more complex. And those that have transitioned back to a biennial budget did it primarily to encourage long-term planning and also go from one-year legislatures to two-year legislatures, or from a long-term in 1 year and a short-term on an off-budget year. And that seemed to be the most significant trend. When I contacted five states, and what I can do that probably would give you some of the best insights, some of the questions that have been brought up or some of the comments, is I can just tell you a couple of the fiscal analysts' opinions on what has worked well and what hasn't. One opinion is there's definitely less stress on the legislature. The legislature allowed the off-budget year to contain only adjustments for the following areas. And in Arizona, they chose that rather than having an open-ended supplemental bill, kind of how Alaska does, they allow the governor to submit adjustments to the appropriation measure. It can allow only technical corrections, only non-general fund increments, and only caseload-driven changes. So basically, the formula-funded programs would be up for review on any year, and all other programs would have to fall under technical corrections or non-general fund. That was one way they dealt with the off-year budget. And in that year, when I called him, the person who I spoke with was thrilled because the legislature's adjusted bill took 3 weeks from the time it was introduced to the time it was passed because of those restrictions being placed on it. So,
What state was that?
That was the state of Arizona. Yeah. In Connecticut, it began its budget reform in 1991. The state was operating on a 20% deficit, which was $961 million deficit to their general fund. Their budget reform bill included an income tax proposal, multi-year budgeting, and a spending cap. And those are all things that this legislature has been addressing, and but that was sort of the premise of their getting into a biennial budget cycle. On the downside, in Connecticut, the off-budget year was supposed to be focused on performance measures, and the fiscal analyst's opinion was that it hasn't really happened because the governor has had such significant changes in the off year, and that neither the executive branch nor the legislative leadership were as interested in performance measures as they thought they were. So they have not really pursued that. So, and that's just his opinion again. In Oregon, the opinion there was that a biennial budget tends to be slightly more conservative if the budget is limited to the revenue forecast. And in the event revenues drop lower than the forecast, a special session is called to deal with the shortfall. If revenues increase, the budgets are locked in and savings can be realized. So it kind of balances out the ebb and flow of a revenue stream. He also said that because it's developed on a two-year cycle, a biennial budget is fairly constant. Agency budgets are developed over an 18-month period rather than about a three-month period now. The governor has more time to review the agency requests, and complete budget information is provided 1 month prior to the start of a legislative session rather than, like, as the session starts, so does all the information that's being gathered. So it gave a little bit more preparation time to his legislative nonpartisan staff. In Texas, which is one of the resource states, their resource impact has a smaller impact than Alaska's, but it does have the revenue, the oil revenue ebbs and flows that we do. Two of the most significant questions that he said our legislature should consider on biennial budgeting is, he said, how do you estimate future needs 3.5 years from the time of budget preparation to full implementation? And I went back and looked at the fiscal years according to the resolution that you're looking at here. And the fall forecast, which is fall of 99, would be forecasting the revenues and our projected expenditures through the year 2002. And so that is a long range forecast that you would have to look at, and that there would be 18 months to look at the revenue, you know, and to be able to analyze that rather than 3 months. And the second significant question was, are there provisions where the legislature can meet in times of crisis? And there are a number of different avenues that states take. Some of them call special sessions. Some offer the supplemental bill. Some have emergency boards or something similar to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee that have different levels of power. Some of these kind of repeat themselves. 2 year budgets force agencies to plan and prioritize for the long term. A movement growing in Congress to abandon 1 year budget system and a call for 2 year federal budgets. This hasn't yet occurred, but Texas has been called on, I think, 2 years in a row to testify on biennial budgeting at the congressional level. And outcome-based budgetary process will place even greater emphasis on long-range planning by state agencies and discourage the tinkering and micromanagement that one-year budget is more likely to produce. Two-year budget gives agencies the flexibility to concentrate on how best to produce results rather than on how to justify spending needs before the legislature each year. So these are all just opinions. Things.
And the tinkering comment was...
What is an opinion?
Direct tinkering by who? Did they specify?
By the legislature.
Yeah. Tinkering by the legislature.
Yeah, actually the way it's written, it's micromanagement and tinkering that the legislature would exercise more of an oversight function rather than getting in every year. So
one person's tinkering is another person's oversight.
That's true. That's very true. Like I said, opinion. In Washington State, time savings within an agency allows that agency to focus on the issues at hand rather than budget preparation. The downside of biennial budgeting is that the cost of starting new programs is more tempting. If a new program is presented in the legislature, and they agree to fund it on the second of a two-year cycle, when that budget is presented the next time around, it has a two-year fiscal growth rather than a one-year. And so it's harder to describe that kind of a growth in a budget rather than looking at an annualized growth each year.
Representative Bundy? Did they mention then that most new programs occurred in that second half of the cycle then?
He didn't say that, but he did sort of, I guess he sort of inferred that did happen.
That's the town to do it.
Yes. Yeah, one of the examples he gave is on new construction projects. I guess the one that I'm most familiar with is like some of the youth correctional centers that we have. We budgeted to build them, but at this point they are not budgeted to be fully staffed. And so that would be something where the first year it looks great to build them, the second year how do we fund them? And then when you do the next two-year budget cycle, you have a two-year increment that would look astronomical. And then the last comment that was fairly significant is that an office similar to what we have, OMB, has to be more diligent about planned spending on a two-year process so that an agency would not put itself into an emergency situation where they have overspent, say, the first year and a half of their cycle and don't have enough remaining to finish out the budget year.
So. Are there any questions of Ginger? Representative Davies.
In the case of Texas, did you have any discussion about the fact that a large fraction, I think it's in excess of 80% of their budget, is essentially in what we would call dedicated funds? That the legislature, in terms of GF funding, only has control of about 18% of the budget. Did that issue come up?
Yeah, we did talk about that a little bit. When we started looking at what they call dedicated funds, it's very similar to also what we call statutorily designated. And they have a greater percentage of these dedicated funds or non-general fund funds. Compared to what we have. But they also have municipal revenues that pay for a lot of things that, where our state pays for it on a state level, they pay for it on a municipal level. And so it was hard to really figure out how much control did their legislature have over general funds compared to Alaska's legislature's general fund pot. So we didn't really draw an accurate comparison there.
It is tough in that sense, you're right. Mm-hmm. Any other questions of Ginger? Thank you very much for the time and the research. I think most people found it interesting. Tracy, did you care to talk about, as I think Ginger called it, more of the dollars and cents?
Tinkering.
The tinkering.
Tinkering factor.
For the record, Tracy Carpenter with Legislative Finance. To be honest, I came today more prepared to answer any questions that the committee might have about our quantitative analysis.
You want to recap the analysis, Tracy?
Sure. What we did was basically attempted to estimate the amount of time that is spent by agency staff in budget preparation, budget presentation, and also and the amount of dollars basically that are spent on travel. For both of those things, and so we broke them down into those three categories: presentation, preparation, and travel. Looking at current year situation, as in the annual budget cycle, also looking at if we went to a biennial cycle, what it might cost in the second year, and what it might cost first year, and what it might cost in the second year. I think Mr. Farnioli pretty much summed it up as far as dollar savings. What we're really looking at in terms of hard numbers are just pull those types of numbers together and We pretty much came real close to the Office of Management and Budgets numbers. We were within $1 million pretty much in all scenarios, so very happy about that. If you have any specific questions about how we did that, I'd be happy to answer those.
Are there any questions of Tracy? Representative Davies?
So on the overview, again, where do you see the bulk of the savings coming from?
In terms of real savings, even dollar savings, you said we travel on per diem. Productivity is savings largely on the staff that the administrative services director level and administrative managers and budget managers spending their time preparing and presenting. That's where the biggest productivity savings would come. There are probably what we can't necessarily quantify right now are overtime, uncompensated overtime that's spent doing those types of items. That could be, if the overtime is not necessarily redirected, but reduced and maybe pulled back into the regular work day and refocused that way, then those are things that we can't quantify right now, but could possibly expect.
I apologize for those who are in the audience who are waiting for House Bill 350 or 265. Because of the interesting debate this issue produces, felt it was pretty important to get all the public testimony on, so I don't believe we're going to get to House Bill 350 or 265 today. So they will be noticed at a future time. Any further questions for Tracy? I was just looking through the fiscal notes. Now, thank you very much, Tracy. I believe the next person we have up is Tam Cook. Good afternoon, Tam.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Tamara Cook from the Legislative Affairs Agency, and I'm here primarily to answer any questions that anyone has about technical aspects of the bill. I can point out that the original version differs slightly from the, well, perhaps significantly from the Judiciary CS. The Judiciary CS added Section 1, which is the provision that addresses the length of session, of the regular sessions. In addition, the Judiciary Committee took a look at two provisions in the Constitution now that are difficult to deal with in the context of developing a biennial budget constitutional amendment. One of them is the existing constitutional provision dealing with the appropriation limit, which, as you know, has never come into play. It's never had a practical effect. It is drafted on the premise that we're going to be comparing a single fiscal year to a single fiscal year. If it is amended to look at two fiscal years, as a matter of mathematics, you have a substantively different result. A similar provision is in the Budget Reserve Fund. It is subsection B, which has also never been utilized as a practical matter, and which contains a formula under which the legislature can access budget reserve fund money based on a comparison of what money was available for appropriation from 1 year, from a preceding year, versus a current year. Likewise, as a mathematical reality, if you take that provision and have you simply look at a two fiscal year period to a two fiscal year period, you've substantively changed that provision. For example, if you have a fiscal year that that is low, and then it is offset by a fiscal year of high revenues, the legislature may never be able to access under B where it could have if they looked at it on a single fiscal year basis. So both of these can only be amended in a way that have substantive effects. Because of concerns over the best opinion, and the worry about having too many elements in a single constitution, it was the decision in the Judiciary Committee not to address either of those provisions, to leave them anomalously speaking in terms of single fiscal years in a double fiscal year system, and to let the accountants deal with it if either provision came into play. Now, what the original bill did was in the case of the first one, the appropriation limit, it simply doubled the limit. It hit it with that type of a crude hammer. In the case of the Budget Reserve Fund, subsection B, it simply repealed the provision, which has never been used. Those both dropped out of the Judiciary Committee version, basically based on best concerns, that we'd be adding two very volatile additional subjects to the bill. And as far as I know, that's the only legal issue that's lurking with this particular constitutional provision.
Are there any questions for Tam? Very good. Thank you very much, Tam. Appreciate you spending your time.
Okay.
Carla?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm primarily here to answer any questions that people might have about how much the legislature would save if we shortened the session during the second session. And that figure is actually around $27,000 a day. So each day that we would decrease the session, it would be about $27,000 less. A lot of that is the session per diem. That's about $9,500 a day. But we anticipate if the session were shortened, we'd have an increase in long-term per diem claims, so that offsets it a little bit. The other thing that would happen with the legislature is we would have reduced staff. During the session, we have more staff than we do during the interim. And those are the two major components of what makes up the $27,000.
So what was the actual fiscal note of savings, Carlo, that was produced by...
We didn't prepare a fiscal note, but if the second session was a 60-day session, we would save $1.6 million. And every other year.
Are there any questions for Carla? Thank you very much, Carla. I believe, Representative Phillips, were there any other folks that you had?
No. AML wanted to, but I don't see that they're back. They have meetings today. So.
Right.
I think that would be all.
I think that was everyone that I had on the sign-up sheet. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on teleconference on the biennial budgeting proposal? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Now, we'll close public testimony on the bill for today, and we will hold it and take to allow members, if they have potential amendments, to prepare them and take it back up again either later this week or next week. So are there any other issues to come before the committee today? If not, we have tomorrow on the schedule, we have House Bill 290, the Stranded Gas Pipeline Carriers Bill, House Bill 344, the Natural Resources and Alaska Hard Rock Land Exchange. At 1:30, we will also have discussion on House Bill 265, the Ardor Extension, at that time. So unless there's anything else to come before the committee, we are adjourned until 1:30 tomorrow.